Right, we're starting here on the bottom of Chav Chedem Adbet, El Omer Rava. The Gemara is working through the sheet of Rava. We had first concluded at the top of the Amud that Alma Kasava Rava Mitzvot Ein Srichot Kavanah. We concluded that Mitzvot do not require Kavanah. Abaye then extrapolated that and said that also has impact on Bal Tosif. If you don't require Kavanah to be Yotze the Mitzvah, you also don't need Kavanah in order to be in violation of Bal Tosif. The Gemara asked a number of questions from Mishnayot, Braitot, which they answered up. And then now finally we brought the position of Rava, and now we've amended the position of Rava based on the Mishnah from Zivachim. And this is the conclusion of Rava's Shita, which is Elama Rava, Batseit Lo Bayi Kavanah. In order to be Yotze the Mitzvah, one does not require Kavanah. There is no requirement of Kavanah to be Yotze a Mitzvah. Lavor Bizmano. In order to be in violation of Bal Tosif, while you're in the context of a mitzvah, lo bayi kavanah. There you also do not need kavanah. Since you're within the context of the mitzvah, then if you do something extra in addition, then that's considered to be Bal Tosif. Shelo bizmano, if you're outside the framework of the mitzvah, then bayi kavanah. If you're going to do the mitzvah or extend the mitzvah, then you require kavanah. So to sit in the sukkah outside the time of Sukkot, you're not going to be in violation of Bal Tosif unless you intend to be sitting in the Sukkah and to be Yotze the Mitzvah of Sukkah, because there's no reason outside of the framework of Sukkah to believe that when you're sitting there, you're doing it for the Mitzvah, but rather just to be in a gazebo or inside of some shaded area. So there you will need positive intent. So Amar Le Rabbi Zeira L'Shamei, Rabbi Zeira says to his servant, Ikavein V'tokoli, have Kavanah, and blow for me. Now obviously, Shamei here is not a servant in the classic sense, because if he was an Eved Kenani, he would be Chayav in Mitzvot, just like an Isha, so that wouldn't have worked. And I'm assuming he's not an Eved Ivri, it doesn't exist in the time of Rabbi Zeira. Talking about here, Shamei is his Shamish. Shamish who took care of him. So he says, Ikavin v'tokoli, have me in mind, and blow for me. Alma kazavar. We would conclude from this that mashmia bayi kavanah. The one who's blowing the shofar requires to have positive kavanah to be motzi, the person that he is blowing for. So that would be different than what we've seen from Rava. So meitevei, heya over achorei beit ha-kneset. Osheya beito samuch le-beit ha-kneset. He's passing behind the shul, or his house is adjacent to the shul. B'shama kol shofar, and he hears the shofar being blown, or kol megillah, the megillah being read. Im kiven libo yatsa. If he's intent to be yotzei, fine. Vim lav lo yatsa. If not, then he's not yotzei. V'chei kiven libo may have. Just because the listener is mikaven libo, why does that help him? Heich lo mikaven adate didei. The reader or the tokeya don't have in mind this individual. If you're telling me that the blower of the shofar requires positive kavanah to include anybody who he's being motzi, this individual is certainly not on his mind. So where it says, Ocha b'shliach tzibur askinan. There we're dealing with someone who is representing the whole tzibur. The date akuli alma. He has in mind anybody who can listen to the shofar, anybody who can hear his megillah. He doesn't have anybody in particular in mind. He has in mind the entire tzibur who is the listening tzibur. Tashma, kavin shomeyav lo nitkavin mashmia. If the listener has kavanah, but the tokeya, the one who is performing the mitzvah, does not have kavanah, or nitkavin mashmia, the one who is doing the mitzvah has kavanah, v'lo nitkavin shomeya, but the listener doesn't have kavanah, lo yatsa, ajid kavin shomeya u'mashmia, until you have kavanah on both sides. Ketani mashmia dumya d'shomeya. There's an equivalence drawn between the one who is performing the mitzvah and the one who is listening to the mitzvah. Ma shomeya shomeya latzmo, just like the shomeya only has to have kavana for himself, af mashmiya mashmiya latzmo, so too the mashmiya only has to have kavana to be motzi himself. Biktani lo yatsa. Over there it says lo yatsa. When are you not yotzei? You're not yotzei when the mashmiya doesn't have in mind anything. But he doesn't have in mind to do the mitzvah. But as long as he has it in mind to do the mitzvah for himself, that suffices to work for the person who is listening. He doesn't have to have particular kavanah for the person who's listening. He just has to have kavanah to do the mitzvah. If he's doing the mitzvah, then the other person can pick up the mitzvah by just having kavanah to do the mitzvah at that time. So that would be against what Rabbi Zeira just said, because Rabbi Zeira requires particular kavanah from the mashmia to whomever is listening. Now, Shliach Tzibur, he has a broader brush, and he covers anybody who hears him, but still he requires that you have kavanah for whoever is being yotzei the mitzvah with you. Gemara says, Tanayehi, it's actually a machloke tanaim, the Tanya, Shomeya, Shomeya la'atzmo, u'mashmia, mashmia lafi darko. The Shomeya has to have in mind for himself to be yotzei the mitzvah. The mashmia just does what he's doing. He's doing the mitzvah, and we assume that if he's doing the mitzvah and performing the mitzvah himself, then anybody else who's listening is captured. Rabbi Yossi, b'med, when's that true? B'shliach tzibur. That's only true when you're dealing with a public officiating person, because there they have general kavanah to be motzi everybody. But when you come to a yachid, then we require directed kavanah, which is the requirement that the shomeya and the mashmiya have particular kavanah in these cases. So it turns out that Rova and Rabbi Zeira's machloket about whether mitzvot tzrichot kavanah is actually a machloket tanaim that's evidenced by the breita that we just brought over here. And we have a machloket. Rova says mitzvot einan tzrichot kavanah. There is no requirement of kavanah by mitzvot. Whereas Rabbi Zeira over here says that mitzvot tzrichot kavanah. And not only do they tzrichot kavanah, but the mashmia has to have particular kavanah to be motzi, the individual, and the individual listening has to have kavanah to be yotzei the mitzvah, prayer, full-fledged kavanah. Shliach Tzibur has a little broader perspective, but he still requires kavanah to be motzi. What's the halacha with regards to this? Machloket Rabbi Zeira and Rova. So it's actually a major, major machloket between the poskim. The Rif and the Bahag seem to favor the position of Rabbi Zeira, that mitzvot tzrichot kavanah, because the simple reading of the Braita about the Shomeya and the Mashmiya sounds like you do require a kavanah. We answered for Rava yesterday, oh, that's just if he was blowing just to make noise, so then it doesn't count. But that's a little more of a dochak answer to support Rava. If you read the simple interpretation of the Braita, it seems to be that Rabbi Zeira is correct, and therefore they paskin that you need kavanah in order to be yotzei the mitzvot. On the other hand, the Balamor argues there on the Rif, the Ritz Geut, quoted later on by the Tor, also all say no. Halacha is like Rava. The halacha is like Rava, that mitzvot einan tzrichot kavanah, that they do not require kavanah. There you have a machloket, whether mitzvot tzrichot kavanah, mitzvot einan tzrichot kavanah. There is a group of Rishonim who say that l'chatchila, the din is like Rabbi Zeira, that we do require a kavanah, but b'diavad, that the halacha is like Rava, that if you didn't have kavanah, you still, you'd say the mitzvah. The Rambam seems to make a distinction that the Ran claims that the Rambam is making, which is, there's a difference between what type of mitzvah, what mitzvah you're engaged in. Certain mitzvot require kavanah, because by definition, you're not getting hanah from it, you're not engaging with the item, so therefore you must have kavanah in order to be yotzei the mitzvah. Other items, like eating, and certain other physical interactions where you're getting hanah and you're eating, whether you have kavanah or not, you're eating and you're getting that hanah, and therefore in those items you may not require kavanah. We have such a concept by ein mitasek bi chalavim in arayot. By eating and by arayot, there's no such thing as mitasek, because you, by definition, are engaged because of the physical pleasure that comes from it. There it's talking about with regards to violations of those mitzvot, but it might be true on the positive side as well, which is that when you're forced, like avuah d'shmuel, when they had kafa'o, when they forced him to eat the matzah, that he still yotzei the mitzvah matzah, because in the end, he ate matzah. Doesn't have to be something where you're doing it l'shem mitzvah. The requirement is to eat matzah, and therefore if you eat matzah, then you are yotzei the mitzvah. That's a third group of Rishonim who believe that you do require kavanah, except for cases where it's known for sure that you're not asik in the mitzvah. Shulchan Aruch paskins that mitzvot tzrichot kavanah brings down v'yesh omrim, he brings down both sides of it, but he favors the side that says that mitzvot tzrichot kavanah. The Magen Avraham there says that only applies to mitzvot d'oraita, not to mitzvot d'rabanan. By mitzvot d'oraita you tzrichot kavanah. By mitzvot d'rabanan will be mekil and say that you do not require kavanah. The Grua disagrees and says that you mitzvot tzrichot kavanah in both instances, both the mitzvot d'oraita and mitzvot d'rabanan. Now, the Mishnah Brura mentions that When you're in the context of the mitzvah, and there's an obligation to do the mitzvah, we assume that you have kavanah for the mitzvah. So if you show up in shul to hear the shofar, and you're there on Rosh Hashanah, we assume that your kavanah is to be yotzei the mitzvah. You don't have to have active kavanah to say, I'm going to be yotzei the mitzvah of shofar. Be a nice thing, but you don't have to have it, because by the fact that you showed up in shul, and that you're listening to the shofar, then of course you're doing that for the mitzvah. So context can help you. When you're in the context of a mitzvah that you're obligated to do, that might be sufficient in terms of generating the required kavanah. Therefore, in cases like sukkah on the first night, matzah on the first night of Pesach, places where you are obligated to do the mitzvah, the situation that you're in makes it clear that you're trying to do the mitzvah. Over there, you may not need as strong or as positive a kavanah, because context and requirements make it that you're doing the mitzvah. The problem comes up in situations where you have a reshut, where it's optional. For instance, sitting in the sukkah for the remainder of Sukkot. So there is context enough. Since it's the Sukkot, therefore, when you sit in the sukkah, you don't say the sukkah. Or the remainder of Sukkot, where there's no obligation to sit in the sukkah, then maybe you have to have active kavanah. So the Mishnah Berurah, the Berurah Halacha, favors saying that you need require active kavanah in those cases. And if not, you might actually run yourself into a problem. You have a requirement to eat in the sukkah, and you don't have kavanah to eat in the sukkah. You're just going and eat. If you don't have kavanah, it's as if you didn't eat in the sukkah, and as if you ate outside the sukkah instead of inside the sukkah. You may not be mekayim the mitzvah, you actually might be in violation of not doing what you're supposed to do, because you just ate outside. You didn't eat in the sukkah. So he says that it's important to have positive kavanah with regards to mitzvot. The Minchot Chinuch has a chakira, which is interesting. He says that, for instance, a person goes into a sukkah where the schach is stolen, and therefore it's a mitzvah ba'aveira. So over there, we agree that you're not yotzei the mitzvah of sukkah. But with regards to whether you violated not eating in the sukkah, Minchot Chinuch says that maybe, in terms of being yotzei the mitzvah, you weren't yotzei, but you're also not in violation of eating outside the sukkah, because you ate in a sukkah. Might have not been the way to accomplish the mitzvah, but you ate in a sukkah. So based on that, he might disagree here with the Ber Halacha and say that in cases where you don't have positive kavanah, like in the case of sukkah outside of the first night, you might not be yotzei the mitzvah, but you also might not be in violation of the mitzvah, because context is enough to have you not be outside the sukkah. It may not be enough to have you be yotzei the mitzvah, but at least you're not outside the sukkah. So there is a machloket achronim when you don't have proper kavanah in the sense where there's no obligation, where you're not obligated to do the mitzvah, it's a reshut. And therefore, one should be careful whenever they're doing a mitzvah to have kavanah to do the mitzvah, to put on tzitzit. All these types of mitzvot which are optional, we opt into, it's important to have kavanah to do the mitzvah, because there's no automatic necessarily kavanah, because context and chiyuv don't exist. Context may exist, chiyuv may exist, but you don't have both a lot of times. And therefore, it's important to have kavanah for the mitzvot, when we do the mitzvot. All right, next Mishnah. This Mishnah, interesting Mishnah, shows up in the middle of nowhere, almost a non sequitur to everything we've been saying with regards to the shofar. We'll give a second after we read the Mishnah, we'll try to give an explanation as to what it's doing here. Vaya kasher yarim Moshe yado, gibig gavar Yisrael. When Moshe raises up his hands, Bnei Yisrael are victorious. Do the hands of Moshe, do they make the battle? Do they cause the losses in the battle? What do the hands of Moshe have anything to do with the battle? As long as Bnei Israel looked upwards, and they put their hearts towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu in heaven, then they were victorious, they were successful. If not, then they fell before their enemies. Similarly, we have another case like this, which is Aselech Asraf, Besimoto al Nes, should make for yourself a serpent, a snake, and put it up on a pole, on a flag. And anybody who is bitten then by the snakes will look up at the snake and be cured. This is what became the symbol for medicine, the modern day symbol of medicine is from this. Is this kapur nachash that is sitting up on a pole? Is that what saves a person's life? Is that what causes them to die? When Bnei Yisrael look upward, and they put their hearts toward the Kodesh Baruch Hu in heaven, ayu mitrapim, then they were cured. V'im lav, ayu nimokim, and if they not, then they were subject to the bites of the snake and the neural course of the venom from the snake. Cheresh shoteh v'katan, in motzim et rabim yidei chuvatam. Cheresh shoteh v'katan, who are not obligated in the mitzvah of shofar, therefore they cannot be motzi others with the mitzvah of shofar. Zakal koshenu mechuyab b'davar, inu motzi et rabim yidei chuvatam. Anybody who is not obligated in the mitzvah cannot be motzi the public or others in the mitzvah. The latter half of the Mishnah is more understandable, at least it has to do with the shofar and it's fitting in. The first half of the Mishnah brings in two cases, almost unbelievably. What are these doing in the middle of Rosh Hashanah? And what do they have to do with everything we've been speaking about until now? My brother-in-law made a suggestion. I think it's true. I've spoken about it in other contexts, not in the context of the Mishnah, but he points it out here in the context of the Mishnah, which is that the Mishnah is clearly implying this with regards to the shofar, which is that here we have two instances where there's a symbol or there's an action that's being taken, but the action in of itself doesn't seem to be the reason for the victory. Moshe raises his hands. B'nai Yisrael are victorious when Moshe raises his hands. When he puts his hands down, they lose in the battle. So what does Moshe's hands have to do with anything? Why should Moshe's hands do anything? Ela, Moshe's hands are a symbol by which the people are Meshaved Libam L'Shamayim. That's what causes them to look up to heaven, and it triggers a feeling or it triggers a thought process which brings them closer to Kodesh Baruch Hu and makes them victorious. Same thing with regards to the Nechash HaNechoshet. By the Nechash HaNechoshet, the Nechash HaNechoshet itself does not provide a cure. There's no reason to believe that the Nechash HaNechoshet had any powers to it. So why, when they looked up to the Nechash HaNechoshet, are they suddenly cured? Because the Nechash HaNechoshet is not the end. It's the means. It's the means by which one gets a wake-up call to get closer to a Kodesh Baruch Hu and to look up to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. In addition, all the symbols are the antithesis of what you would have thought. In the case of the snake, you have to look at a snake after you got bitten by a snake in order to get cured. It seems almost ludicrous. Also, by the Yadav Shel Moshe, Yadav Shel Moshe are like Vayadayim Yedei Esav, which is the methodology by which Esav goes to battle. But a kol Yaakov. So again, it's the antithesis of what you would expect to be the symbol or the siman for Bnei Israel. And even though the symbol is just the opposite, it procures the cure or it helps win the battle. And that's all to show that it has nothing to do with the siman. The siman is exactly that. It's a means to get to the end, which is Meshabdim Libam Leaviyam Shevashamayim. That they understand that everything comes from Hashem, and they dedicate themselves completely to Hashem. And the same is true by the shofar. The shofar is not an end in of itself. The shofar is a means to get somewhere. Which is when they blow the shofar, that should be a wake-up call for the person to be Mishaved Libam L'Shamayim. It's a symbol, it's a experiential part of the day, but it's not the end. To hear the shofar is not the end game. To hear the shofar triggers within the person other thoughts, other processes which should bring them closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and should lead them to where they should be. It's especially true today, the shofar, we don't have it in many contexts, except for on Rosh Hashanah. So when you think about shofar, if someone blows the shofar, you think Yom Adin, you think Rosh Hashanah right away. In their day, the shofar was a common tool. It was actually a common tool. If you look throughout Tanakh, you can do a survey of Tanakh, the shofar shows up numerous times in Tanakh. The overwhelming majority of times where shofar shows up in Tanakh is in battle. It is a tool and is an instrument of battle. So I'd always describe it to be the equivalent today of coming into shul and having a 21-gun salute. That's the equivalent of what it means to blow a shofar in the middle of shul. Blow the shofar was a sign that there was a battle coming, that there was war. It's like a frightening situation. Someone comes and shoots off a gun in shul. That's the way equivalent of what it is. So why would that be meaningful in the context of Rosh Hashanah? The answer is that's the answer. It's not about the battle. It's about taking a person, making them aware that there's something here, that you have to take note. It's a call to the person to wake up and to have kavanah and to extend their thought processes beyond the shofar. And that's why this Mishnah is probably here. This Mishnah is implying how one has to view the shofar, one has to view the blowing of the shofar. So what seems to be out of place is actually very much in place. The Mishnah never takes the next step, but implies that the next sequence here should have been the hands of Moshe, the Nechash and the Choshet, and the next thing should have been the shofar. It implies it without ever saying it explicitly, and that's probably why this Mishnah is found over here. The last part of the previous Mishnah is kivin libo. You have to have kavanah. That kavanah, you have to say, what does it have to do with yadav shel Moshe? What does it have to do with the nechash and nechoshet, the kavanah? The answer is that the shofar functions the same way for them to trigger the need for kavanah. But still, why would you bring that over here? You have the same types of mishnayot by brochot, by kriyat shema, by kavanah of kriyat shema. Over here, what's the connection to shofar particularly? So the previous Mishnah talked about Kavanah, but the connection to these cases and Shofar in the context of Kavanah is that here each of them have a symbol or have a trigger that is trying to engender a certain amount of Kavanah, l'shabed libo l'shamayim. Rabbanan, kol chayavim b'tkiyat Shofar, kohanim, levi'im v'yisraelim. Everybody's chayavim Shofar, kohen, levi, v'yisrael, gerim, v'avadim v'shucharim, v'tumtum v'androginus. So all these people are chayavim in Shofar, Kohanim, Levim, Yisraelim, pretty straightforward, Gerim as well. Avadim, Shucharim are Eved Kenani, who is Meshuchar, who now becomes a full-fledged Jew, because while he's an Eved Kenani, he's only Chayav in Mitzvot Ki Isha, and therefore it's a Mitzvot Aseh as Man Grama, and he would be Patur. Tum Tum, Mishum Safek is Chayav. Androgynous, again, Mitzafek is Chayav. Mish, Chetzio Eved, Chetzio Ben Chorin. Someone who is half an Eved Kenani, half a free person, for he was owned jointly by partners. One partner freed him, the other one did not free him. Then he's also chayav in the mitzvah of shofar. Tumtum eini motzi lo et mino v'lo et sheinu mino. Tumtum cannot be motzi another tumtum. He also cannot be motzi other people in general. That's because a tumtum is a safek. And if we were to clarify the safek, it could be that one tumtum is a female in the keva, and the other one is a zachar, and because of that, they can't be motzi each other, not just the fact that they can't be motzi others. Androgynous motzi et mino. Androgynous can be motzi someone else who is an androgynous. That's someone who displays sexual characteristics of both male and female. So in that case, motzi et mino. It can be motzi someone else who shows the same characteristics, someone else who's an androgynous, because there, the determination is that they're all one category. As opposed to tum-tum, who doesn't display any sexual characteristics, our fear is that when you, quote-unquote, open him up, if you're able to determine in the end which sexual orientation they have, then you would clarify, and it might be different for each individual. By androgynous, who displays both, that is a category by itself, and whatever we determine for the category, everybody would have the same status within that category. So therefore, he's motzi et mino, avalo et sheino mino. But he can't be motzi someone who's outside of that because we're not sure. It might be that he's determined to be female, might be determined male, might be determined that he's a bria bifnei atzma, its own category. As far as themselves, he can be motzi another and androgynous, he can't be motzi other parties. Mi shechetzio eved uchetzio ben chorin, eni motzi lo et mino, v'lo et sheino mino. He can't be motzi not someone like him, and not someone that is not like him. Amamar. So now we're going to go back and break down the braito. Hakol chayavim b'tkiyat shofar, kohanim, levim, v'yisraelim. Pshita. Why would you think otherwise? Why do you have to say kohen, levi, Yisrael? Why would you think they're not chayavim in the midst of shofar? So, ihani, lo mechayve, man mechayve. They're not chayavim, then who is chayavim? I mean, these are the basic components of Klal Yisrael. Why would you think they're not chayavim? So, when it says kohanim, it's trichalei. We need the kohanim, it's true, they're probably levi as well. Sakadat chamino viktiv, because it says in the pasuk liyom trua yelechem, mandalete el betkia dechad yoma hu demechayev. The one who is a chayav in one tkia, he will be chayav in the dinim of Rosh Hashanah in the chiyuv of blowing the shofar. Vani kohanim ho vitnehu betkia dekol hashana. These kohanim, since they are required to blow tkiot all year round, this week's parsha, dichtiv, utkatem b'chatzotzrot, alolotichem, you have to blow the chatzotzrot on your olot, on your korbanot. Ema lo lichayvu. Let us say that they're not chayavim in shofar Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is a shofar that's unique. If you don't have that experience of being unique to you, then you don't have to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Kohanim are hearing the blows of the trumpet every day in the Mikdash, because of the korbanot, which is tkatim b'chatzotzrot alolotichem, eimel olachayvo, that they shouldn't be chayav, kamashman, that they are chayavim. Where it says, midami, how can you even compare the klesis? Hatam chatzotzrot, v'hacha shofar. The psukim in Balotcha are talking about the trumpets, they're talking about chatzotzrot. The pasuk in Emor and the pasuk in Pinchas that speak about the shofar, they're talking about a shofar, not a chatzotzrot. They're two different instruments. They're different. How can you compare the two? Even though We're going to see later on in the Masechta that there are people who compare the two. And the Midrash, if you look on the Midrashim, on the Pasuk and Balotcha, they do quote this as a source for Rosh Hashanah. And Rashi, on the spot, says this is the source for Malchiot, Zichronot, and Shofarot. So there are those who learn it. The Ramban, also, if you look in the Ramban on the Torah, he claims that the Shofar that was blown by Yericho is based on this din by the Chatzotzrot. So you see that there are many people who are comparing the Shofar and the Chatzotzrot, but here, Gemara makes an unequivocal statement that they're different instruments and you can't compare them. Ella, Itzrich, we need it for a different reason. Salkadat Chamin Oil Vitznan, Shaveh Ayovel the Rosh Hashanah, the Tkiyah the Brachot. Our Mishnah said before that Yovel and Rosh Hashanah have the same din with regards to the Shofar and with regards to the Brachot. We said that the Yom Kippur of the Yovel, you blew the Shofar like you did on Rosh Hashanah, and you said the Brachot, Machiyot Zichronot V'Shofarot, like you did on Rosh Hashanah. That comes from Gzeirah Shevel, we'll see in the last Perek, between Rosh Hashanah and Yovel, and how we learn out the Tkiyot. We learn out all the Tkiyot from combining all the Tkiyot of the Chodesh HaShvi'i, all the Tkiyot that are both associated with the Yovel and Rosh Hashanah. That's how we get the minimum number of Tkiyot and Truot that you need on Rosh Hashanah. So there is some connection between them. So man de ite b'mitzvot ha-Yovel, ite b'mitzvot to Rosh Hashanah. Whoever is subject to the mitzvot of the Yovel will also be subject to the mitzvot of Rosh Hashanah. V'ani kohanim, ho v'letnehu b'mitzvot ha-Yovel. They do not have a requirement to carry out all the mitzvot of Yovel. It's not. We have a Mishnah in Erachin. Kohanim v'levim mochrim li'olam v'go'alim li'olam. So this is one girsa, is that these mochrim li'olam and go'alim li'olam, there's an other girsa that Rashi quotes from his other Rebbeim, which was mikachim li'olam v'go'alim li'olam. Rashi says it really doesn't make a difference which one it is. Tosafot favors the other girsa and says that he thinks the girsa should be that mikachim li'olam v'go'alim li'olam, because the Kohen is not subject to the regular rules of Yovel when he's Mekadesh Hestei Achuzah. Person who is Mekadesh Hestei Achuzah, that's a Sadeh that belongs to him through inheritance, he's Makdishit, he has the right to redeem it. If he does not redeem it before the Gizbar, before the treasurer of Hekdesh sells it to his third party, once it's sold to a third party, a person cannot get his field back. And when the Yovel comes, the field is Yotzei LaKohanim. Whichever Mishmar has the Mishmar on the Yovel, all the land that was done in this manner will go out to the Kohanim. He will never see his land again. That is the din with regards to Yisrael. On the other hand, with Kohanim and Levi'im, if they're Magdish, they're Stei Achuzah, even if the Gizbar sells it to a third party, when the Yovel comes around, they get their field back. It does not go out to the Kohanim. So they're not subject to the regular rules with regards to Yovel. There happens to be other rules that they're also not subject to, which is why Rashi says the gears that we have is okay. For instance, redeeming a field. Yisrael must wait 2 years before he redeems a field that he sold, before he can then buy it back or have the right to buy it back. Kohanim and Levim have the right to buy back their fields immediately. So they're also not subject to that rule. In addition, houses in walled cities. A person who sells a house in a walled city, if he sells it and does not buy it back within the first year, the sale is complete and final, and he'll never get back, even on the Yovel. The Yovel have no impact. Once again, that is not true by the Levi'im and Kohanim. If they sell a house that's in a walled city, they do get it back in the Yovel. They're not subject to the permanent sale after 1 year. So there are all these rules that are different between Kohanim and Levi'im vis-a-vis Yisraelim. But Tosfot says the one that's most relevant over here with regards to Yovel is with your Makdish the Sadeh. When you makdish the Sadeh, then the Yovel really has impact here, because the Yisrael has a different outcome than the Kohen if the Gizbar sells their field after they're makdishit. So therefore, that's why he says the Girsa here should be makdishim and goalim. Ema b'mitzvah de Rosh Hashanah lo lechayvu. So maybe they should not be chayav in the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah. Mashmalon that they are chayavim in the mitzvah of Shofar, despite the fact that they're not chayavim in the mitzvot of Yovel, or they don't have the same din with regards to the mitzvot of Yovel. There was an additional girsa over here, kamash malon, the letnehu v'ashmatat karkot v'ashmatat ksafim. They don't have anything to do with hashmita karka and shmita ksafim. As Rashi eliminates the girsa, Tosfot tries to defend it at first and then gives up. He says, hashmatat karkot and hashmatat ksafim have nothing to do with the Yovel. Right, they have to do with Shmita. We're talking about Shmita, not about Yovel. And Shmita Ksafim is connected to Shmita, and there is no Shmita Ksafim on Yovel. So it has nothing to do with Yovel. Shmitat Karkaot, he tries to reread it and say, oh, it's not like regular Shmatat Karkaot, like Shmita, but Shmatat Karkaot means the Karkaot going back to their owner, or Shmatat Karkaot losing the Karka to the Kohanim. But then once he gets up to Ksafim, he runs into a problem and he says, well, maybe it's according to Rabbi, who says there is a connection, but in the end he gives up and says, probably should not put this in the Girsa, because it has nothing to do with Yovel. So now, Mishachetzio Evet, Bechetzio Ben Chorim, Ein Motzi Loed Mino, Vlechenu Mino. Amar Rav Huna, Ulatzmo Motzi. At least he can take care of himself. If he blows for himself, he's not worse off. Whatever he is, he did for himself. So, whatever his standing is, he can take care of his own self. Rav Rachman, the Rav Huna, Maishna the Achirim, Delo. Why can't he be Motzi others? Delo Ati Tzad Abdut, Umepik Tzad Chirut. Why can't he be Motzi anybody? Because half of him is an Evet still, an Evet Knani. And that's what causes the problem. So let's mo nami. Lo ati tzad avdut tidei, or maybe tzad cherut tidei. His tzad avdut will cause a problem for himself. Elo amar Rav Nachman, after etzmo eno motzi. Nachman says he can't even be motzi himself. Because his problem is not only a problem for others, it's a problem for himself. He has two parts to himself. He can't separate between the two parts. And when he's blowing the shofar, both parts are participating. And the tzad avdut is a problem for the tzad chirut of him, and therefore he can't be motzi himself. Of course, Rav Huna's argument is that whatever is the mixture that causes the shofar, then he's also yotze because he's hearing that mixture, and that whatever he's creating takes care of himself. Rav Nachman says it's not sufficient because there really is an issue here. His two tzadim are mutually exclusive. Since they're mutually exclusive, one can't help out the other side. Tani Nami Yochiv, a bright that supports Rav Nachman's understanding. So not only can he not be motzi others or other people like him, he can't be motzi himself. Tani avo breid Rabbi Zera. Kol habrachot kulan afo pish yatza motzi. When it comes to all brachot, even though you've already made the bracha, you can make the bracha again, even though you're yotzi. You can make it again in order to be motzi other people. Chutz mi birkat alechem or birkat hayayim, with exception of brachot on bread and wine. Bread and wine are just examples of a category which is birkat ha-ne'enin. When it comes to birkat ha-ne'enin, you can't be motzi unless you are chayav. There's no reason for you to go ahead and make another bracha unless you're going to enjoy. The reason for the bracha, as Rashi says, is because it's asur for you to be ne'eneh mi'olam hazeh without a bracha. So over there, it's a matir to allow you access to the item, but you have to have necessity to get access to the item. There's no obligation on you to make a bracha. But I'll tell you, you can't make the bracha, don't eat it. You can't make a bracha, don't smell it. I mean that there's a way to tell the person, just desist from doing it, and you won't have to make the bracha. No obligation to make the bracha. When you make the bracha, it's because you're opting in to do something, and therefore you have to make a bracha. Based on that, you can't have a second person come and make a bracha for you on your behalf, unless they're going to engage in the item as well. On the other hand, when it comes to obligations, chovot, where you are obligated to do the mitzvah, and you're obligated to make the bracha, then you can make the bracha for yourself. And even after you've made the bracha for yourself, you can also make it for someone else. Because, birkat alecha, birkat ayayim shelo yatza motzi. If you have yet to make the bracha, then you can be motzi someone else. Vim yatza, in a motzi. In that case, if you're ready yotze, you can't be motzi. But, with regards to birkat and mitzvah and birkat chova, you are able to be motzi someone else, even if you've already done the bracha, even if you've already done the mitzvah, based on the principle, as Rashi says, Sherei Yiskol Yisrael Arevim Zeh the mitzvot. We have joint culpability, joint responsibility with regards to the mitzvot, and therefore, if a person has to do a mitzvah, you possibly are obligated to help them do the mitzvah. Now, my brother-in-law pointed out that with regards to Arevut, there is a general chakira with regards to an arev. An arev in the normal sense, a guarantor of a loan. What happens when the debtor defaults on the loan, and now the arev, the guarantor, has to come in and pay up for the debtor? Whose obligation is he discharging? Is he stepping in and paying for the love? The love defaulted. So now he's covering the deficit of the love. He's paying the obligation of the debtor. He's acting on his behalf to take care of it. Or is the arev discharging his own obligation? He might have an obligation here. As the guarantor, when he entered into the transaction, he basically obligated himself to pay. If the debtor comes in and pays first, then he is off the hook. But if the debtor doesn't come in and pay it off, he is personally obligated to pay it. Whose obligation is he discharging? That's a chakir in general and a guarantor. Is the guarantor discharging his own obligation or is he discharging the obligation of the debtor? You could say the same thing here with regards to arevut b'mitzvot. When we say kol Yisrael arevim zeba zeba mitzvot, does that mean that when another party has to do a mitzvah, am I helping him do his mitzvah? Am I helping him discharge his obligation? Or is it now become my obligation? Since I'm his guarantor to do the mitzvah, it's actually my obligation to do it. So the formulation in the Rishonim between the Ritva and the Ran seems to follow that line. The Ritva seems to say that you're discharging that person's obligation. That person has an obligation, you're helping them fulfill that obligation. On the other hand, the Ran seems to say that you're discharging your own obligation here. I'll come back. The nafkamina between these two approaches as to whether it's your obligation or the other person's obligation. I'll come back to that. Alright. So now, Bayrovo, Birchat Alechem Shel Matzah, or Birchat Ayayin Shel Kiddush Hayom, Birchat Alechem of Achilat Matzah, and Birchat Ayayin Shel Kiddush Hayom. So these are Birchat HaNe'anin that are wrapped up inside a Birchat HaMitzvah. Mau, Kevan Dechovahu, since you're obligated, you're forced to do the Birchat HaNe'anin. True, to drink wine in general, you have to opt in to drink the wine and then obligate yourself in the bracha. Over here, you don't have an option. In order to do Kiddush, you have to have wine. So yes, it's a Birkat HaNenin, but it's a Birkat HaNenin that's being imposed on you. So therefore, now when you have a Birkat HaNenin that's imposed on you, does it take on the trappings of a Birkat HaMitzvah? And therefore, you can be motzi someone, even though you're not going to drink the wine? Or does it still remain or retain its status as a Birkat HaNenin and you can't be motzi? So that's exactly what Rav is asking your question. It says, Kevan dechovahu mepik, since it's an obligation, he can be motzi others. So Dilma, brocha lav chovahi. The brocha is not a chovah. Your chovah is to drink the wine. Okay, now that you have to drink the wine, then you must make a brocha. But the brocha itself is not the obligation. The drinking the wine is the obligation. So Tashma, damar avashi ki avinem be rav papi, have a mekadish lun. When we were by rav papi, he used to make kiddush for us. Vichi hava ati arisei midabro. And when his sharecropper used to come from the fields, come back in, have a Mekadosh Lo, he used to make a Kiddush for them as well. So here he made Kiddush multiple times. So you see from this that you're able to make Kiddush multiple times, and he's able to make Bori Priya Gofen multiple times, even though there's a Birkat HaNenin that is embedded in the Bracha. So the Birkat HaMotzi and the Birkat HaYayin here, because they're incorporated or part of a mitzvah, then they take on the trappings of a mitzvah where there's an obligation, where there's a chuvah, and therefore you can be motzi someone. That's it, exactly right. If he had to drink, then there'd be no question, because then he can make Bori Priya Gofen and he drinks. But over there we have a principle that generally a Mekadosh Serach Shiitom, the president is Mekadosh, has to drink, but in instances where you're not going to drink, or you say, for instance, a person's walking home from shul, and there happens to be a family, there's an amono on Yitomim, and they ask him to come in and make Kiddush for them. But he's not going to sit and eat with them. So he's going to make Kiddush, but he's not going to sit and eat, so it's not a Kiddush Makom Suda for him. Nevertheless, for them, it is a Kiddush Makom Suda. So he can make the Kiddush for them, and then he can give them the wine to drink. They drink the wine, and his Kiddush works for them, because for them it's a Kiddush Makom Suda, even though for him it's not Kiddush Makom Suda. So you can have someone else do the Ti'ima besides the Mekadosh. Tanrabanan, lo yifros adam prusa l'orchim. As opposed to this, a person cannot break bread for his guests. Ilengein kein ochelim hem, unless he eats with them. So here, this is birkat hanenin. Even though you have guests that show up, you can't break bread for them because it's a birkat hanenin. So they're going to have to make bracha themselves. You can't make it on their behalf. Aval porei su levanav levnei veito kedei lechanchan mimitzvot. He can do it for his children or for his household, again, because of chinuch. Even though he already made the bracha and he's already eating, he can make another birkat hamotzi to teach them to make the bracha of hamotzi in order to do it on their behalf. Because they may not be able to do it themselves. They don't know what to do themselves. So then he can make the bracha again, even though, quote unquote, it's a bracha shenet tzricha, he doesn't need to make the bracha. Nevertheless, b'tzad chinuch, he's allowed to make the bracha. U'b'halel u'megillah, afo pish yatzah, motzi. It comes to halel and it comes to the megillah. Even though you're yatzah, motzi. Even though you're already yotze, you can be motzi. This happens all the time. People read the Megillah multiple times for people. Even though you've already done the mitzvah, you can be motzi others. Same thing with shofar. After one's blown or heard the shofar, they can go and blow for people again. That's the whole idea of yatzah motzi. The question is with regards to who makes the bracha. For instance, a person blows shofar, and then later on, after shul, they always have a shofar blowing for the women who couldn't be there. So the Baal Tukei already heard the shofar and heard the mitzvah of shofar during the davening. Now he's going to be motzei the women. So we have a principle here, yatsa, motzi. Even though you're yotze, you can still be motzi others in the mitzvah. But who should make the bracha now? Should the bracha be made by the Baal Tukei, or should be made by the people who are being yotze? So in general, we favor those that are, you being yotze the mitzvah, they should make the bracha. Although many of the poskim say that even the tokeya can make the bracha, can make it on their behalf. But that might be the difference, what we said before, the nafkamina in arevut, depending how arevut works. When I am arev for someone else, am I discharging their obligation, or am I discharging my obligation? If we're discharging their obligation, then it's more likely that they should make the bracha, and not you, because the obligation's on them, and they should make the bracha. On the other hand, if you view arevut as being that I'm discharging my obligation to help them to do the mitzvah, and it's my obligation, then there can be an easy way to understand why you, as the tokeya, could make the brachot. That actually might be the nafkamina between those two views or those two positions with regards to arevut, which is who should make the bracha or who can make the bracha in that instance. All right, with that we end the perek, and now we move in full throttle into shofar and all the dinim of shofar. Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah Shechal Liyot B'Shabbat. Yom Tov Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbat B'Migdash. Hayu Tokim. In the Migdash they used to blow, Avalo B'Medina, but not outside of the Migdash. What is Migdash? What is Medina? Rashi over here says, Migdash means literally Beit HaMikdash. Medina means not in Yerushalayim, not in the Gvulin. Nowhere outside of the Migdash. That's Rashi's definition, as well as most of the Rishonim. 99% of the Rishonim say Migdash means inside the Migdash. Outside of the Migdash means anywhere outside, including Yerushalayim. They did not blow shofar on Shabbat. The Rambam over here in the Perush HaMishnayot, as well as we saw this by regards to Lulav, he says the same thing in the Perush HaMishnayot with regards to the din of Lulav in the Migdash. He says that when the Mishnah over here says Migdash, it does not literally mean Migdash, but rather it means Yerushalayim. The word Migdash is a general term for the entire Yerushalayim, and therefore the Rambam says that on Shabbat they blew shofar in Yerushalayim, not just in the Migdash. He says, Kvar Bianu Pe'amim, we already mentioned this numerous times, Ki Migdash Tikra Yerushalayim Kula. Definition of Migdash is all of Yerushalayim. U'Medina Shar Areyot Shebchol Eretz Yisrael. And Medina means anything outside of Yerushalayim. So it does have Nafkamino to Alocha. I mentioned this when we did it with Lulav, that people come up to Yerushalayim during the Chag, try to take Lulav again when they're in the Old City, because according to the Rambam, there's a mitzvah d'oraita all 7 days of Lulav in Yerushalayim, not just in the Migdash, but in Yerushalayim. So if you go to the Kotel during Chol HaMoed, kedai to pick up the Lulav again, because you might be yotze the mitzvah d'oraita, when you did it back in your house, you only yotze zecher the Migdash, did it mitzvah d'rabbonon. Same is true possibly by Shofar. There is a story of a Rav who subscribed to the position that Rambam here and would blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah that fell out on Shabbat inside of Yerushalayim. His peers prevailed on him and told him that he can't blow the shofar. It's not right. We don't pass him that way. So every year, right around the time it was for blowing the shofar, he would disappear from shul. Nobody knew where he went, but it was pretty obvious that he was going to blow the shofar, because he believed that when you're in Yerushalayim, you blow the shofar on Shabbat. All right, now, Mechazaram Beit HaMikdash, once the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Hidkin Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai Shitukim B'chol Mokom Sheyesh Bo Beitin. Made a takana, anywhere that there is a Beitin, that they would blow shofar on Shabbat. So now, this takana of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is also subject to Machloket. What does it mean, Beitin? The Rif writes that it means any Beit Din. You do not have to have smuchim. You don't have people have smicha. If you require smicha, then this whole practice ended because we don't have smicha anymore. And since we don't have smicha anymore, then there's no Beit Din in which you can blow the shofar. The Rif implies and seems to indicate that you require a Beit Din, I mean a Beit Avad. You do not require smuchim. And therefore, in the Rif's Beit Din, they used to blow shofar on Shabbat that fell out on Rosh Hashanah based on the Rif's position. The Ram quotes that from the Rif, and the Rif himself mentions it, that they used to blow in his Beit Din on Shabbat. Amar Rabbi Elazar, lo hitkin Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ele biYavna bilvad. He only instituted this in Yavna. Amar lo, echad Yavna veechad kol makom sheyesh bo Beit Din. No, it makes no difference between Yavna and anywhere else. So ve'od zot hayta Yerushalayim yetera al Yavna. Now, this is what Yerushalayim had over Yavna. So we just saw that they blow the shofar in Yavne. So now what about Yerushalayim? Kol ir shiroa vishomat vikrova v'yicholo lavo tokim. That any city that could see them, could hear Yerushalayim, or was close to Yerushalayim, could go and blow on Shabbat. But in Yavne, they only blew in the Beit Din. Now, the question is, when are we talking about Yerushalayim having something different than Yavne? Rashi says over here, when it was still extant, when the Mikdash was still built and Yerushalayim was still there, this is what they did in Yerushalayim. What do you mean? Didn't Rashi just say before that in the Mikdash they blew, they did not blow inside of Yerushalayim? What's Rashi talking about? That all Yerushalayim bebinyana. You didn't blow shofar in Yerushalayim bebinyana. So, what the Rambam makes a lot of sense now. The Rambam is consistent in his opinion. When he says that Mikdash means Yerushalayim, then the latter half of the Mishnah is self-explanatory. This is what Yerushalayim had over the other cities, or over Yavna, is because they blew shofar in Yerushalayim when the Mikdash was extant. So the Rambam explains the latter half of the Mishnah as being when the Mikdash was built. Well, Rashi does the same thing, but for Rashi it's very difficult to understand. How can you talk about Yerushalayim bevinyana? So Tosafot right away takes up the issue, and he says, Hainu the achara churban. This is after the churban. The blowing of the shofar in Yerushalayim was post-churban. Post-Churban, then what are you doing in Yerushalayim blowing the shofar post-Churban? So Tosafot doesn't explain this, but others take up the position of Tosafot, which is that there was a period of time post-Churban, and there actually was a period of time even pre-Churban, that the Sanhedrin sat in Yerushalayim. That pre-Churban, they left the Mikdash, and they started to sit in Yerushalayim instead of in the Mikdash. So that's number one. Even Bivinyana, when Yerushalayim was still extent, they moved out of the Mikdash of Sanhedrin, moved the Beit Din into Yerushalayim. Then, even post-Korban, it seems that the Sanhedrin stayed for some point in time inside of Yerushalayim and then moved to Yavne. So that's the claim of these individuals, that either whether it was pre-Korban or post-Korban, we're talking about a period of time already when the Sanhedrin's sitting in Yerushalayim, and that's why Yerushalayim is obligated. That's one approach. The Tosfot Yom Tov has a different approach, which is the din of Yerushalayim extends from the Beit Din in Yerushalayim, which is when the Beit Din sits in the Mikdash, you can blow in the Mikdash, and you can blow inside of Yerushalayim. When the Beit Din is not sitting, then you can still blow in the Mikdash, you can't blow in Yerushalayim. The Tosfot Yom Tov says that Yerushalayim was driven by the Mikdash, but not like the Rambam. Not because Mikdash and Yerushalayim are equated, but because when the Beit Din sits in the Mikdash, then all of Yerushalayim is considered to be the place where the Beit Din sits. And that's what Yeter Yerushalayim. Yeterayim has this above that, which is that Yerushalayim can blow shofar even when the Beit Din's in the Mikdash, you can blow in all of Yerushalayim, and anybody that is close to Yerushalayim is covered by that. Now when the Beit Din is not sitting, when they're not there, I mean post-Chatzol, the time when the Beit Din is not in service, then you can only blow in the Mikdash, you can't blow in Yerushalayim. So he claims that that's what Rashi means here, Ba'oda Bibinyana, means that there was a period of time when the Sanhedrin sat in the Mikdash and had an impact on Yerushalayim. Not, again, because Yerushalayim and Mikdash are equated, but because whatever happened in the Mikdash had impact on Yerushalayim. And therefore, post-Churban, of course, Yerushalayim does not have this din. This is also all pre-Churban, according to Rashi, and that's the explanation of the Tosfot Yom Tov. Right now, the Gemara says, Minahane Milei. How do you know this is true? How do you know that on Shabbat, that's Rosh Hashanah, you don't blow shofar? So Amar Rabbi Levi Bar Lachma Amar Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina Katuv Vecharomer Shabbaton Zichron Shua. In Amor it says that it's a Shabbaton Zichron Shua. Tuv Vecharomer, and the pasuk in Pinchas says that it's Yom Shua Yelachem. So why could it be Yom Shua and Zichron Shua? Which one is it? So Kasha can be Yom Tov Shechaliot B'Shabbat, can be Yom Tov Shechaliot B'Chol. When it's a Yom Tov that falls out on a weekday, then it's a Yom Shua, which is that it's a day of blowing the shofar. When it falls out on Shabbat, it's not a Yom Shua, it's a Yom Zichron Shua. We mentioned the psukim of the shofar, but we don't blow the shofar itself. This distinction that the Gemara makes is still preserved till today, that when we say in davening on Rosh Hashanah, if it turns out to be Rosh Hashanah, Shechal Yopi Shabbat, we say Zichron Shua, Yom Zichron Shua, whereas when it is on a weekday, we say Yom Shua. Amarova, imi doraitehi, mimikdash eicha takinan. Says, wait a minute, if this is a din d'oraita that on Shabbat you can't blow shofar, and on a weekday you do blow shofar, then why did you blow a shofar in the Mikdash on Shabbat? Why is it accepted from the din d'oraita? Ve'od, ha'lav melochi, blowing a shofar on Yom Tov is not a melocha. So why did Yitzchak call him Yute? So you need a pasuk to come to tell me that's mutar? What do you mean you need a pasuk that it's mutar? It's not asur that you need a pasuk to come tell me that it's okay to blow the shofar. Or the other way around. I need a pasuk to tell me it's asur. The Tana de Beishmuel, kom lechet avodah lo tasu. You may not do any melechet avodah. This is referring to Yom Tov. And as Tosfo points out, you could have brought a pasuk for Shabbat. It's the same din by Shabbat. Which is, yatzta tkiat shofar v'diat pachi chokhma v'eina melecha. That only restricts you against doing melachot, does not restrict you from doing things that are not a melacha, but a chokhmah, which is that they are something that requires a certain amount of practice, knowledge to do it. It's a skill set, but it's not a melacha. Blowing the shofar and scraping the bread off when it's baked and bringing it whole, those were skills, but they're not melachot. Now they are both asurim midrabanan, but they're certainly not asur midoraita. So if they're not asur midoraita, why do we need a pasuk to come tell me that, first of all, I can't do it on Yom Tov? Why would I think you can't do it on Yom Tov? Rosh Hashanah telling you to do it, then you do it. Why do I need a pasuk to tell me you're not doing it? And on the other way around, why do I need a pasuk to tell me you can blow the shofar? Of course you can blow the shofar. Say, Allah merova midoraita mishrashari. As far as the Torah is concerned, you can blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah even when it falls out on Shabbat. Rabbananu de gozer bay kidirabo. And the Rabbanan goes here because of Rabba's chashash. Everybody's obligated in the midst of blowing shofar, but not everybody knows how to blow the shofar. So maybe he'll have the shofar, he'll take it for amot and reshut rabim to take it over to the baki. He'll carry it for amot and reshut rabim. Vainu taima to lulav, vainu taima de megillah. Gzeira derabo applies to lulav. Why don't we take lulav on Shabbat? Shema yavirenu dalamot birshuta rabim. Why don't we read Megillah on Shabbat? Shema yavirenu dalamot birshuta rabim. So all of these items are excluded, even though midoraita they are required. The Chachamim told us to do a shevi al taaseh, and do not blow the shofar on Shabbat. Do not read the Megillah on Shabbat. Do not take the lulav on Shabbat, despite the fact that minat Torah, you should be taking it on Shabbat. You should be doing this. Now, with regards to Yom Tov, even though on Yom Tov we don't have a problem of carrying on Yom Tov, because carrying is permitted on Yom Tov, as long as you're doing it for a purpose. If you carry for a purpose, you're allowed. If you're just carrying the shofar stam, it's problematic. You only carry the shofar if you need the shofar, if you need to blow the shofar. So then it's permitted. But you still have the restriction of the Isur Rabbanan of playing musical instruments. Of course, that's waived when it's for the mitzvah, blowing the shofar. But if you're not doing it for the mitzvah of blowing the shofar, then we tell you don't play around with the shofar on Yom Tov, because it's Gzeira Derabanan of Shema Yitakin Klei Shir. So that applies to someone who's not blowing the shofar, an adult. With regards to Ketanim, there, you're allowed to. For Shum Chinuch, you're allowed to play with them, meaning that if they're trying to learn how to blow or they want to blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah, you can help them to blow the shofar, because that is proper Chinuch, or that is part of the process of Chinuch on Yom Tov. The halacha even brings that on the Shabbat, as long as it's not Shabbat of Rosh Hashanah, if the child is learning or playing around with the shofar to learn to blow it, you could actually help him blow it, because there's no takana. You're doing the same mitzvah or to learn the mitzvah, and there might even be permitted on Shabbat before Rosh Hashanah. Say the Shabbat before Rosh Hashanah, not the Shabbat of Rosh Hashanah itself. Ma brings it down the halacha that if a child is playing around the shofar after you finished in shul and you don't need to blow the shofar anymore, you don't have to stop him, and if he needs your help, you're allowed to help him in order to learn how to blow the shofar. Now, with regards to Rosh Hashanah and Shabbat that coincide, there we do not blow the shofar. And that's despite the fact that earlier in the Masechta we saw that the word Mereshit Hashanah, Arachrit Shana, the Gemara learned there that Kol Shana Shirash B'Tchilata, any Shana that is poor in its beginning, then is good in its end. And there the Gemara also said that Kol Shana does not have a shofar in the beginning, ends up badly. So that would be a bad omen in terms of not blowing the shofar on Shabbat on Rosh Hashanah. So over there, the Rishonim note that that does not apply to a case where Rosh Hashanah coincides with Shabbat and you don't blow the shofar, then that's not in effect. And there, you have to invoke the principle that the Sheva Altase, the Gezeret Chachamim tells us what to do. And therefore, that will carry us through to the end of the year. And there are many who say that it's that our Shmirat HaShabbat and the davening or the psukim that we say that replace the shofar. So you have to have extra kavanah for those items on Rosh Hashanah that falls out on Shabbat, because otherwise we don't have anything in place of the shofar on that day. Mishchara Beit HaMikdash Shekin Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai Tanu Rabbanan Pam Achad Chal Rosh Hashanah Yod B'Shabbat Rishonim fell out on Shabbat. But you kol ha'arim mitkansin. All the cities came into Yavne. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai moves the Sanhedrin from Yerushalayim to Yavne. He negotiates with the Romans in terms of the surrender of Yerushalayim. He asks for a number of things. One of the things he asks for is Yavne v'chachameh, to leave Yavne intact, to leave the Beit Din of Sanhedrin intact. So he moves, or basically has the Sanhedrin move from Yerushalayim to Yavne, even though it seems to be at least a large part of it was already in Yavne by the time of the Churban. So the people were used to going up to Yerushalayim to hear the shofar on Shabbat that fell out with Rosh Hashanah. So there they didn't go up to Yerushalayim because Yerushalayim is no longer extant. So they go to Yavne. They come together. That's what Rashi says. They came. That's what they used to do in Yerushalayim. That's a question of when. Again, goes back to the question of the Mishnah. When did they used to go up to Yerushalayim? Was that when the Mikdash was there or even when the Mikdash wasn't there? But since they did in Yerushalayim, now they wanted to come to Yavne. Amaleim Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai livnei b'teira nitka. Let us blow the shofar now for them. Amrulo nadun. Let us discuss the issue. Let us have a debate about whether it's right to blow the shofar on Shabbat in the Beit Din. Amaleim nitka v'achar kach nadun. Says, we'll blow and then we'll have the discussion. We don't want to keep the people waiting. So we'll blow the shofar and then we'll have a discussion about this. Lachashataku. So after they blew the shofar, amrulo nadun. Okay, let us at least debate the issue now. Amaleim kvar nishma karen b'yavna. Shofar was already blown. After it's already done, what's done is done and you can't take it back. And if we were now to retract this, then it would look bad. It would make us look like we made a mistake and you don't want to undermine the power of Beit Din and undermine the power of the Chachamim. What's in place is in place. So that's how Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gets the institution of Shofar in place. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai institutes many things, Zecher the Churban or post-Churban is another one of these items. B'nai B'teira, we know, were the Nesiim in Eretz Yisrael, because if you remember, we had the story in Pesachim with Hillel, Habavli, that comes up to Eretz Yisrael, and they have a case where Erev Pesach falls out on Shabbat, and they don't know if they can shech the Korban Pesach or not. And that the B'nai B'teira are discussing that with Hillel Habavli. So the B'nai B'teira are in charge. So here have another incident or issue where Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai and B'nai B'teira are having a little bit of a debate about whether they should do this, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai prevails in getting it to be that they blow shofar in a Beit Din, even outside of Yerushalayim. Amar Rabbi Elazar lo itkin Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai b'Yavne bilvad. Amrulo echad Yavne v'chad kol makom sheyesh bo Beit Din. Amrulo haynu Tana Kama. Those that are responding to Rabbi Elazar, who says that Yavne and Beit Din are the same thing, is saying the same thing as Tana Kama, which is anywhere there's a Beit Din, you can blow with a shofar. So Gemara says Zika beinayo Beit Dina dekrai. Then between them is a temporary Beit Din. The way that the latter, the ones who are responding, the Chachamim that respond to Rabbi Elazar, are saying it is that Echad Yavna, Echad Kol Makom. They're comparing the Bati Dinim to Yavna. Yavna, which is a permanent Beit Din, a Beit Din that is there full time, is always there, so too. You can blow in any Beit Din that is there all the time. On the other hand, the Tana Kama just says, wherever there's a Beit Din, you can blow. It doesn't have to be something that's always there. If they set up a Beit Din for this purpose, or they have a Beit Din there that's temporarily housed in this location, that's enough to blow the shofar, and that'll be the difference between the Tana Kama and the Chachamim in the latter half of the Mishnah. Okay, we'll stop over here. Well,